Good evening and welcome to Little Atoms. Little Atoms is a live talk show about ideas. Each show features a guest from the world of science, journalism, politics, academia, human rights, or the arts in conversation. If the show has a dominant and recurring theme, then it coalesces around the ideas of the Enlightenment, by which we mean freedom of expression, free inquiry, empirical rationalism, scepticism, the scientific method, secular humanism, and liberal democracy. These ideas find their antithesis in superstition, religious fundamentalism, fanaticism, medievalism, totalitarianism, censorship, and conspiracy theory. Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. I'm Padraig Reedy, and I will hand over to my co-host Neil Denny to introduce this week's guest, Chris French.
Thanks, Padraig. Chris French is a professor of psychology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and heads the Anomalistic Psychology Research Unit, which he founded himself in the year 2000. He is a chartered psychologist and a fellow of the British Psychological Society, and he also co-edits the Skeptic magazine, which is the magazine that this radio show and podcast is the official podcast of. Chris, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And we should begin by talking about anomalistic psychology and basically, what is it?
A very good question. I mean, I didn't actually come up with the term anomalistic psychology, but when people used to ask me, you know, what's my research interest, I would come out with something like, well, it's the psychology of ostensibly paranormal experiences and beliefs and related stuff, which is always a bit of a mouthful. So I thought, now I've got to have something a bit shorter there. I know. Anomalistic psychology. And now, of course, people just say, well, what is anomalistic psychology? And I have to say it's the psychology of ostensibly paranormal experiences and weird stuff. And so that's essentially what it is.
People might question why we would study the weird stuff, basically. What would be the, you know, because as a scientist, as a psychologist, it could presumably be assumed that we would think that the stuff that you study isn't true. What would be the value, the scientific value of actually studying it?
Well, that's a very good point, and is one that's often raised. Mm-hmm. You look at opinion poll after opinion poll, and you will find that the majority of the population of this country, of other Western countries, of, in fact, any country, anywhere around the world, at any point in history, do believe in this stuff. And therefore, if we as psychologists don't have anything to say about that, we're missing out on a very important part of human experience. Not only do people believe in this stuff, there is a sizable minority of the population who claim to have had direct personal experience. And so again, if we can't explain what's going on there, then that leaves the field wide open for people to come in and say, well, you know, these paranormal things, they are all true, ghosts really do exist, people really are being abducted by aliens, telepathy's real, the whole lot. And we need to be able to say, well, hang on, yeah, it's a possibility, but there are these other possible explanations, which actually I'd say were a lot more plausible.
I mean, you just mentioned a couple there, but I was just going to suggest that we perhaps button down what are the things that you study. Let's talk about some of the things that the centre actually studies.
I mean, again, pretty much anything that's got the label paranormal attached mm-hmm. to it would be fair game for anomalistic psychology. So that covers extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, precognition. We'd actually take a fairly loose definition of the term paranormal, looser than most parapsychologists would take. So we would include in all the other weird stuff. We'd include in astrology, aliens, the Bermuda Triangle, firewalking, you name it. If it's weird and wonderful, and it doesn't even have to be paranormal necessarily, we're interested in the kind of whole belief systems that people adopt, why people can sometimes find this evidence so compelling, where you and probably most of your listeners who may be a little bit more critical and a bit more scientific in their approach would find the evidence far from compelling.
Chris, it's simple to say, I mean, you're talking about things like ghosts and astrology, which you think, well, it's stuff from our ancient past that people believed in, they didn't know any better. But is it as simple to say that it's just some kind of cultural stroke, evolutionary kind of blip, or is there more going on?
I think in one sense there is more going on. I mean, one of the interesting questions to ask is, well, why are those kind of beliefs so enduring? Why is it still the case that so many people believe this stuff and have done for centuries? Mm-hmm. And, I mean, what that would tend to suggest is that we're dealing with beliefs that are arising out of something very fundamental about the way that our minds work. I suspect that the reason that we have a lot of these beliefs is precisely because of the limitations of our cognitive systems. We are prone to certain cognitive biases. Now, again, that raises the question, well, why are these biases actually survived? Why do we still make these mistakes in our thinking? And I think the answer to that is that we have evolved in such a way that our cognitive systems are good enough. We make kind of quick and dirty decisions a lot of the time. We don't sit down and ponder and think things out rationally. You know, if you think of this in evolutionary terms, it makes a lot more sense to make a quick decision that shadow you've just seen out of the corner of your eye might be a saber-toothed tiger, so get the hell out of there, rather than sit there and pondering on it. You know, so we've got these brains, basically, that are designed or have evolved to make these kind of quick decisions. You know, we're very, very successful as a species because we pick up on patterns in the environment around us. We're very good at picking up on cause and effect relationships and so on. But there's a price to pay for that. Sometimes we see patterns when actually there isn't a pattern there. Sometimes we think there's a cause and effect relationship when in fact there isn't. But it's probably better that we've got cognitive systems that are very quick and right most of the time, rather than slower and right slightly more often.
It occurs to me something like alien abduction, I can't imagine was on the radar, say, 100 years ago. Is there any equivalent now that's a new thing emerging? Can you see new phenomena, new kind of beliefs in paranormal phenomena emerging, apart from the ancient ones of ghosts and so on?
I think new ones will come and they will go. I mean, the example of alien abductions is an interesting one, insofar as one of the important factors that's probably involved there is something called sleep paralysis. Mm-hmm. You find a lot of the cases, not all of them by any means, but a lot of cases involve situations where people have had this weird experience where they're kind of half awake and half asleep, and they realise they can't move. And, I mean, that's fairly common. About 40% of the population seem to get that at least once in their lives. It's a bit scary if you've ever had it. In about 5% of the population, you also get associated symptoms like hallucinations. So people will see dark shadows or grotesque creatures or lights moving around in the bedroom. They might hear voices or mechanical sounds, etc., etc. Now, if you've had that, it's pretty damn scary. Most people just shrug it off as a weird kind of nightmare. Some people, however, if they come across the ufological literature, may actually come across the idea that what's probably happened is you've been abducted by aliens, and they've wiped your memory for the rest of the experience. So you may then go along for hypnotic regression. Hypnotic regression doesn't, in fact, provide this kind of means of uncovering repressed memories. It's a really, really good way of generating false memories, particularly if you go in there knowing what you expect to find. Now, I say the reason I'm talking about sleep paralysis is because if you look back in history, you'll find that exactly the same experience was interpreted in different ways in bygone times. So in the Middle Ages, pretty much exactly the same experience would be interpreted as an attack by sex-crazed demons. Mm-hmm. This was the incubus and the succubus, and they'd have their evil way with you while you were asleep. If you look to other cultures, they have their own interpretations of what's going on. And so it's a nice example of the same core experience being interpreted in different ways in different cultures. And I'm sure that, you know, these things will evolve. At the moment, angels seem to be quite popular. They seem to have made a comeback. And again, a lot of the time, because sleep paralysis experiences aren't always negative, sometimes they can be quite euphoric and blissful, it's quite likely if you had that kind of experience and you are religiously inclined, you'd think you've been visited by an angel.
I wanted to talk about the methodology of, you know, the work of the Animalistic Psychology Research Unit and how you actually go about investigating these phenomena. As it happens, last year you published a paper on the very subject of UFO abduction, which we've already brought up, so we may as well use that as an example. So let's talk about the actual research you did into, you know, how you went about doing the research into the UFO.
Yeah. I mean, what sometimes happens is that sceptics sometimes have a tendency to come up with very plausible sounding explanations, but often their explanations are not actually based on any empirical evidence. And so when you've got something like, say, the alien contact experience, and there are these ideas around to try to explain what is going on, then obviously if you can actually produce some empirical evidence that supports that point of view, then that is great. Now, a few years back, a team at Harvard, including people, I mean, it's great when Harvard do research like this, because, I mean, you know, in terms of the respectability of anomalistic psychology, you say, oh, wow, this is fantastic. But a team involving Susan Clancy, Richard McNally, Daniel Schachter, you know, kind of big names in memory research, did a very interesting study where they took a group of people who had conscious memories of having been abducted by aliens. Another very interesting group who, although they didn't have conscious memories of being abducted by aliens, did believe they had been abducted by aliens. They just hadn't recovered the memories yet. And a control group who didn't think they'd been abducted by aliens. And they gave them a particular experimental task. I won't go into the details, but it's a very widely used task that measures susceptibility to false memories. And what they found was that the group with the conscious memories were more susceptible to false memories. So this supports this notion that these reports of alien abduction may well be false memories because these people are particularly susceptible. Now, what we did in our study, we essentially wanted to kind of replicate their effect and look at a few other things as well. So we got a group of 19 British experiencers. That's the politically correct term. These are people who claimed that they had had alien contact. We gave them a battery of psychological tests.
How did you find them?
We had to put out an appeal. Now, look, obviously, this kind of does present kind of PR problems in terms of, you know, I am a known skeptic, and I can understand why these people may have been a little bit reluctant to possibly take part. And it was very fortunate for us that people like Nick Pope came forward and said, you know, you should support this research. I mean, and I think we can honestly say, well, this wasn't just PR, this bit, that we don't really know in detail what's going on. I think we've got a pretty good idea now, but you know, there is a need for more research. Anyway, we managed to get our hands on 19 experiences via email appeals, internet, appearing on radio programs, etc. 19 came forward and took part. We had a control group which included my mother, so thanks, Mum, which matched on kind of age and gender. And what we found, we got differences on all kinds of measures. I mean, the psychological profile of the two groups was quite different. The experiencers were more prone to dissociation, that's to kind of going into altered states of consciousness. They showed higher levels of absorption. So these are people who get kind of completely absorbed in what they're doing and kind of don't take in distracting things that are going on around them. They were more fantasy prone. They also showed higher levels of sleep paralysis. However, I have to come clean on this, they didn't actually show higher levels of susceptibility to false memories using exactly the same task as they had used in Harvard. I mean, the overall pattern, I think, did support the notion that these people probably were more susceptible to false memories, but it didn't actually show up on our experimental task. At the end of the day, what we could say was certainly these people did show a very distinct psychological profile.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the kind of tempting explanations for uninformed skeptics is to say, well, you know, these people are just all mad, aren't they? They're crazy. Now, there have been a lot of studies that have actually compared groups of alleged alien abductees with control groups, and by and large, they don't show higher levels of serious psychopathology. But they do show rather a different psychological profile. I mean, I think, you know, to some of you probably say they're a bit eccentric compared to other people. Now, again, whether this is cause or effect is another interesting question. Is it the case, as the ufologist would argue, that these people have had their psychological profile shaped by their experience? So it's possible, I think it's unlikely. One of the other interesting things is that the experiences as a whole, this is not something we looked at, but it's very clear in other research, they tend to report a history of having a traumatic childhood.
Mm-hmm.
And this goes across the board for paranormal belief and reports of paranormal experiences in general. And one idea that's been put forward is that as a kind of psychological defense mechanism, when these people are kids, they become fantasy prone as a way of escaping from the harshness of reality. And they also tend to kind of have this thing about dissociating, so they kind of psychologically distance themselves from whatever may be happening. But then, subsequently, these are exactly the kind of people that you would expect would sometimes make mistakes between what was happening out there in the real world and what was happening just in their own fantasy lives. And I mean, and I think that kind of offers quite a reasonable explanation for a lot of these experiences. Not all of them, by any means. I mean, you do have to look at each case as it comes. But I think in terms of kind of talking in generalities, then I think there's definitely a lot of evidence to support that picture.
So not alien abduction?
I think not.
Okay, well, you listen to Little Atoms with me, Neil Denny, and Padre Greedy, and we're talking to Chris French. Our listeners will have heard us talk numerous times on this show over the years about the James Randi Foundation and the $1 million psychic challenge that they have. And you've basically just done yourself and Richard Wiseman, who was a guest a few weeks ago, you've just carried out only a few weeks ago you can explain it a bit more, but one of the preliminary tests. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that next.
Okay. I mean, what James Randi insists on, not unreasonably, is that before you can actually take the formal $1 million challenge, basically $1 million there, which is waiting to be given to anyone who can prove paranormal abilities under controlled conditions. But before you go for that challenge, you have to pass a preliminary test carried out by people that he trusts. Now, in this particular case, we were testing a medium named Patricia Putt. It was quite a straightforward test in terms of its conception. If she really could do what she thinks she can do, then she ought to be able to write a psychic reading for an individual without them opening their mouths or saying anything. What she did, in fact, ask some of them to read a short passage, but it was the same passage for everyone. She says that she can write a reading on the basis of that, and obviously, if the person could then recognise themselves in that reading, that would be pretty incredible. So the basic design was to get 10 volunteers to come along, so that she couldn't pick up any physical cues. We had them wear a ski mask, wraparound sunglasses, an oversized graduation gown, and white socks. And we insisted on having people all from the same ethnic group, and they were all basically Caucasian women, 18 to 30 years old, again, so that she couldn't just base her readings on some very obvious kind of physical differences or ethnic differences or whatever it may be. To cut a long story short, I mean, and this is kind of greatly simplifying all the thought and care that has to go into the test, she did 10 individual readings, then we invited all the volunteers back and got them to go through all 10 readings without them knowing which one was for them. Of course, if Patricia really does have this amazing gift, they ought to see their reading and think, well, that's me, that's incredible. In actual fact, the criterion that we'd used, we said in advance, if you've got 5 out of the 10 or more correct, then she'd pass the test. She got none. So Randi's million is safe for a while yet. Have just stop press, though. She does want to be retested, so we may well end up testing her again in a year's time.
Did you say getting it right? I mean, how specific do you have to be?
Well, not very specific. If you'd have taken part in the test, then she would do a reading while you're in the room. That reading is meant to be specific for you. That should contain details that would pertain to your life. Now, when you come back, you've got that reading plus 9 others, and you don't know which one's yours. Mm-hmm. So if she really can do what she says she can do, you should read through those readings and say, that's me, that one is mine, that describes me and my life, my concerns, that one's me. Now, none of our volunteers actually recognised themselves. They all chose a reading as being the best match to them that was actually done for somebody else.
Uh-huh. Just looking at other psychics and so on, you generally tend to get very vague things, such as you're sad about something, or you're missing an ex-partner or something. Was it that kind of thing she was coming out with? Or?
Well, it wasn't. I mean, because again, I mean, when you get psychics interacting, you know, doing readings for people in their kind of usual setting, mm-hmm. then of course they're getting feedback from the volunteer, from the sitter. Now, of course, if they're doing that, then there's all kinds of other factors that could explain what was going on. There's a technique known as cold reading, which means that you can, if you want to be a deliberate con artist, you can fool complete strangers that you know all about them by using this technique. Now, again, I'm not implying that most mediums and psychics are deliberate con artists. I don't think they are. They really believe they've got a gift. But when you cut out those other possible sources of information, we had the volunteers pretty much covered. They were facing away from the medium with her approval. She says she could still do the readings, so she couldn't pick up on any of those cues. They obviously didn't even know what she was writing, so none of that could come into play under those conditions. The reading that she wrote, which the readings typically had kind of some generalities in them, some bits of quite specific information, but when the specific information was there, it was just wrong. It was inaccurate. And as I say, none of our volunteers recognised themselves in the reading.
Let's just go back to that score, because, of course, none out of 10. I mean, that obviously sounds quite bad, doesn't it? But
there are better scores.
But then, I mean, I've read in literature that 1 out of 10 would have been what you would have expected with Chan. So actually, 0 out of 10 wasn't what I'm trying to get across is, for some reason, I don't know why I'm feeling sympathetic. But, not 10 wasn't actually that bad, was it? It wasn't that far off what you would expect somebody to get.
Couldn't have been an awful lot worse.
No, it couldn't have been worse, admittedly. No, this is true. No, she has, of course, subsequently, as you said, volunteered to do it again, but has also come back and suggested things like that, you know, the garb that that the people were wearing might have in some way been blocking the spirit.
Yeah. Now, that's why I was quite disappointed, really, because initially she took the result on the chin. She was very good about it and just basically said, it's my fault. Now, when we're drawing up these protocols, we have to have the full approval of every point in the protocol from the person who's being tested.
Now, that's a really important point.
Absolutely.
I mean, we'll reiterate that. We should say that again. That, yeah, because people often criticise this and say, well, clearly you're presenting hurdles that are too high for these people to leap. You know, there is no way that they can achieve this. But they agree to the protocols beforehand.
Absolutely. I mean, there is absolutely no point in either testing one of these claimants on something they don't actually claim to be able to do, or testing them under conditions under which they say they wouldn't be able to perform. And so this is the typical pattern. I mean, this is not the first test of this kind I've done on behalf of JREF, and it is a very typical pattern that people will agree to the conditions of the test, they will sign a document in advance saying they are entirely satisfied with the conditions. It's only when they fail the test that they then come up with reasons as to why, actually, now they've thought about it, it wasn't a fair test at all.
But do you find, I mean, as you said, you've done these tests numerous times, and I wouldn't be going out on too much of a limb to suggest that the vast majority, but all of the results have been negative. What's the normal response? I mean, how do you find people? I mean, do they quickly get over it? Do they bounce back?
Oh, they will bounce back. They will absolutely bounce back. I mean, and in a sense, I can understand that. From a psychological point of view, we are talking about people typically who are professional psychics. They make their living that way. It's a hugely important part of their self-identity. Mm-hmm. It's what makes them special. Now, even though they'll go into the test with in total confidence that they're going to be able to pass this test, when they fail it, they're not going to say, oh, well, that's it then, all that
time
other
to
stuff.
Look for another job.
Yeah, obviously, I'm not really psychic at all. They're not going to do that. They are instead going to deal with the cognitive dissonance by saying, well, what can the explanation be? I know I'm psychic, but I didn't pass that test. There must be something wrong with the test. I mean, I think it's inevitable that's the way it's going to go. But again, well, another thing to emphasise is, you know, we don't drag these people in at gunpoint and make them take part in these tests. They want to be tested. They desperately want to be tested. And it takes a lot of time and effort to actually set up these tests and run them. But if they fail them, you can guarantee within a week or two they'll be bouncing back and still making very good livings as professional psychics.
We've only got a couple of minutes left, so we should talk about The Skeptic, the magazine.
I'm glad you said that.
That you co-edit, which I understand is about to be relaunched.
It is indeed, yeah. We've been going for 21 years now. And so to mark that, we are expanding The Skeptic from a wonderful 28 pages to a mega exciting 40 pages. We do have a special offer on at the moment. If people go to the website, which is www.skeptic.org.uk, you can find out details of the special offer. We are going to have to increase our price because mind you, the increase in size more than compensates for the increase in price. And if you get in there early, you can subscribe at the current subscription rate, which is £15 for 4 issues a year. So get along there and do that.
And I can highly recommend their podcast as well.
Their podcast is absolutely unbelievable.
Well, no, I think that's a good place to end. You've got a nice little plug there for both of us. So, thank you, Chris French.
Thank you.
And this has been Little Atoms with Neil Denny and Padraig Reedy, and we'll be back at the same time next week.